Welcome to Value Through Vulnerability. This is a podcast dedicated to putting the human back into humanity, and I'm your host, Gary Turner. I'm also the founder of Hexo Change, and Hexo Change is a transformational change practice dedicated to helping you connect to yourself, to others, and to systems at large in a more meaningful way, thus helping us turn around our workplace and planetary challenges and accelerating how alive we all feel in every aspect of our lives. This track is called Kaleidoscope and was created for me personally and for Hexo Change by Peter Griffiths, one half of the amazing Mind Takeaway. I hope you enjoy this exploration and please do share it on your social platforms so we can bring more humanity to more people. Hope to speak to you soon. Welcome to Value Through Vulnerability. This is a podcast dedicated to putting the human back into humanity. And we are now boosted by Humans First, which is super exciting. And today I have the founder of Humans First, Mike Vacanti, with me, and also Tom van der Luwe, who is one of the co-founders of Visy. So how are you, Tom, and how are Mike? Welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you. I'm very fine. Thank you very much, Gary and Mike, for inviting me.
Yes, it's wonderful to be with you, Tom and Gary. It's fun to step in together with you and start this series of conversations. I'm pleased that Tom is our guest because there's a lot of insight that Tom's bringing to the listeners today.
Fantastic. Well, look, Tom, as we get going, would you mind just sharing for our audience today a bit about, of course, the organization, Visy itself, but also your journey? Like, what was it that moved you to want to set up the organization in the first place?
Okay, a little bit about my background. I'm a little bit more than 50 years old. I have not a typical background for somebody who works in the financial industry. I started to with my studying history. I'm a historian, but also politics and international law. I wanted to become a diplomat. And after studying in the Netherlands, I studied in Paris, Sciences Po. That's where diplomats, for instance, go to. And then afterwards in Berlin. But I find out pretty soon that I'm not very diplomatic. So after a short stay at McKinsey Management Consultancy Company, I started to become a financial planner from the idea of that trying to help people to reach their goals, financial goals, or also, let's say, secure them the negative side of the financial planning. That's what I like a lot. Also the direct feedback you get from clients. And then I worked in this financial planning company in Germany for a pretty long time. I was responsible for a subsidiary in Switzerland and the Netherlands. And from the subsidiary, Visy evolved. We became entrepreneurs by accident because we were just put on the street. They decided to close down the subsidiary. And since then, we focus on mortgage advice, which is a little bit comparable for, let's say, if you take the US, a little bit comparable with social finance or better mortgage in this kind of companies. So we are in the mortgage space, but we are financial planners.
Wonderful.
Great. So, Tom, I'm really intrigued. We're in a very unique time for the three of us and all of us on this planet, this blue orb that we are all surviving on. So I'm really intrigued. You know, what's the journey for you personally as Tom and with Visy as you navigate this really interesting time? And I'd just like you to share maybe some of those experiences of how you're leading at this time.
And we were in a way very lucky that because of the fact that the mortgage business is on a kind of maximum, or you would expect that there would be a recession soon. So I'm not talking about the corona virus at all. So that we said, okay, at a certain point, there will be this turning point and then the economy will go into recession. Let's think about recession scenario. And then we just said, okay, let's just assume that the mortgage market in the Netherlands just loses 50% of its volume. What does it mean for the company? So we had more or less a kind of recession scenario in place, never expected to happen something like coronavirus. I'm not talking about, let's say, what was going on in Asia and if you could have anticipated on this more severely. But then suddenly the crisis was there, and we just had to take out our crisis scenario from the past. And then there was a kind of strategy which we just started, which I can dive into deeper if you're interested.
There's something that really pops up in that for me, Tom, and I think speaks to how you're organized and the mindset of where you put the value and priorities in the organization. And that is, as you are looking at recession planning, knowing that there are peaks and valleys through life, that things do change through the course of business, that your recession planning or taking a look at crisis scenarios actually sits hand in hand with succession planning. And I look at that because of the value you place in the people and the teams and the way you're structured, that understanding the downside that the market may bring also allows you to prepare your teams and succession plan for the success of the business going forward in those different climates.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think that, let's say we were also a little bit lucky that we, during normal times, have a kind of very clear hierarchy in our company. So it always starts with the purpose. So the whole idea is that business is not meant to maximize profits, but it should be a multi-stakeholder approach. So the purpose, we have a double purpose. We want to change the financial sector. It should become more sustainable, more long-term oriented, etc. But we also always had the second purpose, and that was to create a better work environment, putting people first. We always call this, and it always has been on the website. So in the past, I always had to explain that the company which does mortgage advice, which is a business to consumer, let's say, product, that our customers went to our website, and they say, okay, let's see if Visi is the real advisor for me. And then they saw on our website that they were second, I always got this question: how can you put your client second? And then we always said, okay, it's not so difficult. If you put your people first and give them a lot of autonomy and freedom, that is all Daniel Pink, drive video. A lot of people probably know from this TED Talk. If you put your people first, you have a purpose, you give them autonomy and give them the possibility to decide what's the best for the client, you will ending up with a very good, you would call it NPS, or clients will be very happy. So we have on the Trustpilot score, we have 4.9 on a scale of 5.0. So much better than a lot of companies who put their clients first. But I always had to explain. And now in times of crisis, I don't have to explain that much because it's now everything is about solidarity. So I think it helps that if in good times you have a kind of collective team approach or solidarity, that in times of crisis, you have a competitive advantage because suddenly everything is about solidarity and not about maximizing profits.
That's so wonderful. And Tom, you've modeled that for many years in the business, which is fantastic. And what I love how you describe that, and you talked about coming at it with purpose to start with as the basis. And we hear some of these ideas that they're new ideas or they're trends, and that's not the case for you. It was actually the foundation of the business that it would start with purpose. There would be networks of teams. It would be a supportive leadership model. You're very transparent in the financial side, but then also on the relationship side, team to team, person to person, and it's exemplary. As you say, change the financial industry. There's such stark examples of where that's needed, right? In the U.S. we've had the Wells Fargo debacle. We've had the Fifth Third Bank, which outside of needing a really, you know, new marketing team to rename that bank, they went through a similar behavioral meltdown because of the pressures that they were putting on their teams to artificially inflate and create value that wasn't innately there. You've bucked all those trends because you grounded in purpose to start with. And I commend how exemplary that is for a model in the future.
Although I'm not, at the moment we do a lot of interviews, and especially because in these times of crisis, people are searching for let's say good examples, just to have a kind of to balance it, because there are also enough bad examples. But I think that in the end, most small and medium-sized enterprises, no matter where they are in the world, they all behave from a point of solidarity, and that is because on the one hand, they are just smaller, so they know. It's not an Excel sheet. So if you have a huge company and you're sitting in a huge tower and you have an Excel sheet and you don't know the people you're firing, that's another decision than if you work together for a certain time in a factory or in a business and you know those people and you know those families and you know what will happen if you fire them. So I think in general, we are the normal. So the small and medium-sized enterprises, it's also normal to be not egoistic. It's normal to be altruistic. It's normal to help each other. We just talked about in times of crisis, you see this, that people are putting, let's say, pieces of paper around in the city and with their phone numbers, where it's written on, if you need some help, if I can go to the grocery store, please call me and I will do the shopping for you. Without knowing who will call you. So the basic need and the basis of humanity is to help each other and to be to show solidarity. It's not to be egoistic, and that's why egoistic. We don't like egoistic people. We like altruistic people. We like people who help each other, and especially and now let's say you maximize this in a crisis. Where there is no understanding at all, if people who have a huge amount of money and of whom society expects that they will show much more solidarity than people who don't have any money, when they behave in an egoistic way, then there is a huge outcry, and you could call it shitstorm, etc. But you had the situation with Richard Branson in the UK. And there will more examples will follow, but society doesn't like this attitude. And in normal times, it's not so. You don't see it that much because everybody is relatively doing well. But it's a kind of tipping point at the moment where people are sitting at home, and they fear and they don't know if they will be laid off in the next couple of weeks. They start to translate this fear into anger. And on the other hand, they also translate it in likes when people or companies behave in a correct way. If you just see the positive reactions on the Patagonia decision to close down the shops immediately 2.5 weeks ago and pay the rent and the salaries of their people, there was a huge wave of sympathy for Patagonia. And if you act in another way, in the opposite way, there is a shitstorm which hits your company.
I'd love to ask you, Tom, because I really appreciate you sharing just such great insights. And I'd really like to talk a bit more about your business and the sort of self-management holocratic approach that you take, because what you're speaking to, what we're all speaking to, is this very almost getting back to nature. Yeah, we are innately connected. We are all human. We do all want to serve. But we've sort of lost our way, or we've bought into the misdirection of the last 100 years. And I'm just wondering, do you feel that self-management, holocracy, is that a scalable approach? So when you go from 40 to 400 people, do you feel that you can protect the culture and scale it with that system?
Yeah, I give you two answers because I often get this question. The first answer is, and I don't know if you know the book of Frederic Laloux, Reinventing Organizations.
Sure.
It's everything which is really great and complex or complicated structures, it's all self-organizing. So nature is self-organizing, market economy is self-organizing. States are in a way also self-organizing, local communities. So that would be a more scientific approach, but because we're in a crisis situation, I want to make it very practical for people who listen to the podcast and will end up in the same situation where they have to decide, shall I lay off the people? Because all the people around tell me you should get rid of your cost as soon as possible, because that's a good recipe to survive. And I just want to show you perhaps an alternative way, or the way we did it, but we're just one example and a lot of companies are acting like this. So, and I would do this in three steps. So the most simple one is, if you would have to let's say lay off 20%, then you can take an Excel sheet and just say, okay, who are the people who last entered the company, last in first out principle, and you just take them off the Excel sheet, and you say, okay, you have half an hour and you can leave the company. So the little bit more, let's say, and that's the continental European approach, is you have to lay off 20%. You tell everybody and everybody works 20% less. And this is even implemented in legislation in European continental countries. So for instance, in the Netherlands, it's called reducing work times. In Germany, it's called reducing work times. And it's just totally integrated in the whole legislation, in the social security systems, etc. So that's a little bit more intelligent than just laying off 20%. And the positive thing about it is you can use this rather often. So also for seasonal effects, you can also use this all the time. And this is used all the time. And it guarantees companies, especially small and medium-sized enterprises, that they are able to keep the people and keep the knowledge in the company. And the third step, and that's where I want to make the link to self-organizing structures, is, and which is, there's already research done on this, that if you would say to teams, could you please sit together and discuss how you can, let's say, lower the cost of 20%, they come with much more intelligent solutions. And I just give you an example. If you have a team of, let's say, four people, then you could say, okay, everybody works 20% less. But in this team, people know from each other in which situation they are. And you have perhaps somebody who has a partner with a very well-paid job and says at the moment, I better would like to take care of my children. I can work 50%. But somebody else who perhaps really needs the whole salary, because somebody is raising children for her or his own, will say, no, sorry, I would like to, because I understand I have to be I have to show solidarity, and I would like to keep my job, but I just need my 100%. And even with my 100%, it's still not that very easy to keep going. So if you trust your people and you give them the authority to come with better solutions, they will come with better solutions. And you can do this. And that's something which is very scalable. So if you have a huge company, you can just say, if I trust my people, and if I think that they are capable of coming with better solutions, just give them 1 or 2 days to come with better solutions. And then perhaps you have 80% of your teams come with better solutions, and you still can put your energy in the 20% of the teams which are left and which are not able to solve it, because for you don't know at that moment what reason so ever. And that's what we did, more or less. But we're not in the situation yet, but that's our model. But what we did, and that also could help, let's say, managers or entrepreneurs. First, we secured and said, okay, we're not going to lay off, because is this a permanent crisis, or is this just a crisis which will take a couple of months? And everybody says, no, it's not a permanent crisis. It's not about having missed innovation. We're not a travel agency or something like that. And you are disrupted by booking or something like that. No, it's a temporary crisis. And then you can discuss how many months. And then we said, okay, just let's assume for the next couple of months, we don't do any revenue. Let's say, for instance, 3 months or 4 months. And then we said, okay, what's the amount of money we need to just keep the business going? And if you have enough liquidity to keep the business going for such a period of time, you could just say, okay, let's assume we have zero revenue. Let's concentrate the next 3 months on the topics we always wanted to tackle, all the innovation topics. And so that was the second step, the liquidity. And then what happens is, and that's from a psychological point of view, very important. You have the worst case scenario, and it can't, let's say, getting worse than that. So every sign of a little bit more revenue or what happens is that your worst case scenario becomes a little bit better. So our scenario didn't take into account support of the state, didn't take into account that we didn't have to pay, let's say, social security payments, etc. It was not taken into account. So after 2 or 3 days, the first signs were, oh, our worst case scenario will be better. And that's exactly the opposite, which happens on a governmental situation or a communication level. Every new information of the state is, we don't have enough intensive care beds, or we don't have enough machines for breeding, how is it called? Breeding?
Yeah.
And this kind of stuff. So it's very, very important that you have a kind of basis scenario, and then you can build up the company again.
I really appreciate how you drew that belief in the greater good and talked about it in the nucleus of the company and how people engage in that and make those decisions, you know, from the salary standpoint and the 20% solve that you talked about earlier, and then rolled that out really into, you know, societal models and community models, which was wonderful. And I think sometimes people might look at that and say that's an idea and it's a single decision. But Tom, you've done some foundational work within your company and with building this model that allow that belief in the greater good to hold together. Things like when you put people first, when you're running your business, certainly you have an operating model efficiency, and you do all of those things that are business very well, with the intelligence and the knowledge and the know-how to accomplish that. But you also put in the happiness factory, and you put in realizing dreams, and so you do other enriching. You have other enriching focus areas for your people, which, since they're building and they're growing and they're maturing within the organization, those seem to be the foundational anchors then to continue to believe in the greater good. Is that part of the model?
Yeah, what we actually did is that you have a lot of statements, mission statements, and how to behave in companies, and we only have one rule. And that's called the golden rule. And the golden rule is nothing we invented. It's in every religion. And it just means treat other people like you wanted to be treated yourself. And that's the only rule we have. So we don't have a handbook. We don't have a lot of stuff on the wall. That's the only rule. And this has become part of our DNA before crisis times. So, and I just want to take one example, because the question is always, yeah, how do you do this in practice? How do you implement this in practice? So every company knows that at a certain point, people have, let's say, family members who become sick. And we had an example of somebody, of a colleague. Her father was in Spain and got ill. And she went there, and we didn't know when she would come back. And in the first week, it was fine for everybody. And then the second week, you have the first questions. Oh, we have a lot of work to do. When will she come back? And then our reaction is, she will come back when it's fine for her, because we don't know how long her father will be ill. And then you have in the next week, somebody says, but it's really a lot of work. I'm getting a little bit annoyed. And then you have two possibilities. we always take the example, and somebody would complain about this or would put it on the agenda, which is totally fine, a very normal reaction if you have a lot of work to do. We say, if you would be in her situation, how would you like that your colleagues would act on this situation? And that's something which works in any dimension. It doesn't have anything to do with the company or so. And what we always do is then, okay, just think about it and just tell us tomorrow what's your opinion about it. And then you always have the situation that nearly anybody comes back the next day and says, sorry, I would like to be treated in the same way we treat this colleague at the moment. And then you don't need any rules. You don't need a rule that for first grade family, you have so many days, because it's always an individual situation. And try to act as humans towards each other. And that's something which, if this has become part of your DNA, you don't have to invent something new when you're in crisis times, because then suddenly everybody understands what the golden rule is.
Tom, I love the simplicity. Honestly, I read this in one of your articles as well, and I'd love to explore. I think what's so impressive is how you've managed to stay simple, because in a crisis, the first thing you can do is make it super complex.
Yeah.
So I can really sense that golden rule allows you to come from that place of presence at a time when it could be perceived to be quite chaotic.
But that's something which all the people at the moment in crisis times or times of crisis, they act exactly in that way. That's why you find these papers or these small pieces of paper where it says, it's also one in our apartment house here. There's just somebody puts, if I can go to the grocery, just and you can take the phone number. So everybody behaves exactly in this way. So that's the normal. Behaving egoistic is abnormal. It's not accepted. And now it's a kind of, I don't know if it's called acid test it's a kind of, now suddenly you know how people behave from their deeper, let's say, attitude. And whole society expects that people who have a lot of money, they will help as much as they are able to do. And what we don't expect of a lot of people who have a lot of means or a lot of possibilities, that they just run away and say, I'm not interested. I will just tell my suppliers that they will pay the bill 3 months later than normal. And those small suppliers in the end of the chain, of the value chain, what shall they do? They will just go bankrupt.
Yeah. And, you know, the value chain that you just described there, and we had talked earlier about value and how impressive it is that you've held strong value on both the financial side and the operational side, the productivity piece, but also value in people, value in a moral code, value in each other, and those behaviors that support active empathy. I mean, you've really just described what people have written books about trying to describe, and you did it by the actions that are taking place around the golden rule. That's
but
just
I think,
phenomenal.
But I think more or less, it doesn't matter where in the world, all those people are acting in exactly the same way. But if we read newspapers, it's much more interesting to write something about Richard Branson, because everybody knows him and everybody says, oh, I never thought Richard Branson would act like this. I would have thought that somebody who has a huge amount of money will just support. And that's why there's a lot of stuff written about those people, but all those small companies, but also on the private level, I also ask people, for instance, we have a nanny and normally she takes care of our children because we both work full time. We just pay her salary. We don't tell her, no, we don't need you anymore. And everybody does exactly the same. So I just ask a lot of people and they all pay their cleaning lady, etc. They just continue to pay the person. They're not saying, no, no, we don't need you the next 3 months. Bye-bye, sorry for you. Nobody does.
I love that humanity. And I just love how you've spoken to it 3 or 4 times, Tom, which is actually innately we are connected. Innately we want to help each other out. So actually, how do we want to be once this crisis has passed? Because I do believe there is an acid test now. I see it in my home life, I see it in the work life, I see it in society. I think we've got a huge opportunity, Tom, to reset how we are with one another in the workplace. And I really think there's a huge opportunity. And I wonder with you, with your business, with Visy, and also maybe wider, what are some of the challenges right now for you? So we've spoken a lot about the great things that are going on. I'm just wondering for you personally, this is value through vulnerability. Is there any sort of challenges for you personally that you're working through, or maybe some innovations, or what's on your mind right now as Tom, as one of the co-founders?
What I find interesting, and which is also something probably for a lot of managers or entrepreneurs is an interesting aspect, is that if you give this kind of call it psychological safety, because we also mentioned this of Amy Edmondson, if you have the security, you can be productive. And if you have this basic situation of being able to be productive, but you wouldn't have clients for a certain time, but you have the liquidity and you have enough cash, then people are really willing to speed up a lot of innovation, because they want to give something back. It's a kind of social contract. So if you say as a company, you don't have to worry about your salary, we're able to pay the next 3 months. Yeah, this is the cash we have. Let's focus on the innovation stuff. People really will speed up. So the example I always took in the last couple of weeks was, we drive into the garage with a pretty fast car, but after 3 months, the garage opens again and we are driving out the Formula One car, because we really had time, which you normally often don't take, to really work on innovation. So we are working on a lot of things. So in the past, we always said, no, we don't have that much time to produce videos on mortgages, etc. Now we're producing like hell, because now advisors have time to make appointments with our filmer, and in the past said, no, I have to take care of my clients. Now we have time to make videos. We have time to make articles. We have time to invest time in our processes. So there's a lot of stuff going on. So I think it will be really, really interesting in 3 months' time when the garage door opens again, and then other people, or let's say our competitors were, let's say, I don't know. The example I was taking is a kind of rabbit sitting in front of a snake and doesn't do anything because it's paralyzed for fear. And that's very unproductive. Or people just sitting at home and don't know what to do before they are told that they are laid off. So you create an enormous productivity. You can work on stuff you normally don't have time to work on. And then, yeah, we'll just see what happens. What the others did in the last, let's say, if the crisis is over, what they did in the last 3 months and what we did in the last 3 months, I know what we're doing.
Redirecting that energy, Tom, is so wonderful, right? So in time of challenge, where the outside circumstances that you're facing and your team is facing, your teams, there's a response that can say, we're going to continue to do everything we're doing and just push harder until we get through the other side. And I think we hear those examples very often. That seems to be the default setting, is to double down on the things that will no longer yield results. But we've been whipping the horse for so long, I don't know what to do except whip the horse. And what I love that you shared is you repurposed, redirected, knowing that the car that comes out to the garage at the end of the crisis will be an innovative and an advanced addition of what went into the garage prior. And that's such a great lesson for everyone.
I can also give one practical example, because we already talked about this in the press. in one of the main Dutch newspapers on Monday, so 2 days ago, and they asked about do we still recruit people? And then we said, yeah, we do. But I have to explain a little bit more profoundly. We always had the virtual bench, we call this. And it's just a role in our Glassrock holacracy system is just open, so everybody can just dive into that and can even find this role, this responsibility. And we always were in talks with people we didn't need at that moment, but let's say in 2 or 3 years. And now there's a great time to activate this. So what we will do is that when the crisis become more severe, we already plan to go to the newspaper and say, okay, we want to become market leader. We're searching for 180 advisors, and we have 20 now. So and we already know that let's say our competitors don't think that way, because they're really trying to get rid of the mess, or I don't know, they're quarreling, or I mean they are not working on innovation, and they just lose the energy, which goes in the wrong direction. But an aspect which I also find very interesting, which has to do with self-organization, is that in times of crisis, people, because of the responsibility and the commitment, they become much stronger. So certainly, people act and take very active roles without asking and without saying, no, perhaps I'm not really suited for this job, because everybody feels the sense of urgency. And suddenly things are done without being discussed. So I take one example. We have a filmer, and he made a video to as a kind of instruction video internally for advisors how to act when they advise remote by video call. Nobody asked him to do so. He just did it in the evening. And then he put it internally in our Slack channel. Everybody said, hey, great video. It really helped me. And then somebody says, why don't you just put it also online, externally, so it also helps other people. But nobody asked him to do so in the beginning. It was not a point on a kind of meeting. Oh, it would be nice to have an internal instruction video. No, he just said, okay, I want to make a contribution. I think that will help my colleagues. They just did it. And you see a lot of this kind of stuff.
Attracting the best talent. So we hear the term talent war so often, and I love the approach where it's going to be active. We're going to open up and let those who understand and believe in what we're doing, we'll find the best people will come and find us, because this is a better alternative to how others are responding. That's just brilliant, Tom.
But it's also that, let's say, you could say everybody has talent, but if you create a real environment, just people try to contribute what they think help the organization. And it can be totally, it can be different aspects. But let's say the small and medium-sized enterprises, they are not big brands. They pay perhaps lower salaries than, let's say, fancy companies in New York, etc. But they still manage to make great products or great services. But it has to do with the kind of cultural environment. It's not that they always have the most intelligent people. No, they just work together in a more, let's say, they work together in a very good way. They're more loyal to each other. They're more long-term oriented. They support each other in a better way. And they are able to create great results. But it's the culture which is the basis or the fundament under this productivity.
It's so cool. Honestly, guys, I just love this chat, because what I'm absolutely buzzing about is that if I boil down what I've been listening to the last sort of 40 minutes, it's not there's so much in there, but it really is the difference between, are we going to stay fixed? Just think of Carol Dweck's work. Are we going to stay fixed to the old ways of doing and being, or is everybody capable of being better? And Mike speaks to this in his book, Believership, as well. And I think what you're doing brilliantly, Tom, is just unleashing continuously via your culture, your structures, your beliefs. Your people are just continuously renewed energetically. I can sense it. Whereas other people are just feeling trapped and fearful and afraid. But your team's just energetically just like winding up all of the time, is what it feels like to me. It just sounds so, so exciting.
Yeah, thank you. But I think that also happens at the moment in hospitals. Huh?
For
so
sure.
People on the one hand, they say it's horrible. And on the other hand, people say the way people work together at the moment, even people perhaps who are not always brilliantly skilled, people just join in and say, okay, can I help somewhere? The bus and the way people work together now, that's what I read, is so intense, and people feel also a kind of fulfillment on this task, because now you really know what you're working for. Eh? I mean, normally you also are in hospital, but in this extreme times where you have to deal with such difficult situations, people work intensively together, and that also creates a kind of, I wouldn't say fulfillment, because it's a little bit difficult in these times of crisis, but this feeling very close to each other and working on the same task, that's something I think you can sense it in all these articles and all those, also in television, if you just see if they interview people who work in hospitals.
Tom, that's such a brilliant point about how people do rally together to do extraordinary things. And in the hospital example, I think that's wonderful. When we look at traditional leadership ideology, what advice would you give to the management of those great teams doing extraordinary work in crisis situation, like in a hospital? Around acknowledgement. So those people are doing extraordinary things. They are under great pressure. What would be the acknowledgement advice that you would share with the leaders of those groups of people?
Oh, that's very difficult, because let's say hospitals is not my subject. So I always have to be very, reluctant on that, but let's say to put it a little bit more broadly, what I like is the idea of no bosses, everybody is a leader. So if you try to create an environment where people feel safe in their teams, people all will in the end become leaders as they act in normal life as well.
Yes, indeed. I believe that is a powerful statement and a model for the future, and thank you for expressing that.
Just out of interest for me, Tom, in terms of sort of ongoing development within your system, within Visy, what does training look like? What does ongoing development look like? Is it sort of a mixture of peer-to-peer, mixture of external? Would you mind just speaking to that a little bit? Really intrigued around that.
Yeah, it's okay. That's another podcast. But it's let's say what we did is, I tried to do it very briefly. So what we did is that we say, okay, how can you maximize outcome and you can call it happiness or fulfillment, and then you end up with Amy Edmondson, psychological safety, and then just to go fast forward, we just said, okay, just try to take the whole financial bonuses and incentives out of it. So people can be vulnerable, and normally you can't be vulnerable because it has a negative effect on your own salary or bonus, or on the salary or the bonus of the people you're in the team with, because if you give let's say between brackets negative feedback, you know it will have a negative effect on the salary of your colleague. So you can't be vulnerable. So we said, okay, if we just solve this problem by just paying fixed salaries and raise them, and so you also have this Maslow aspect of it, so people can also plan from a private point of view. If you know that you for 40 years we will raise your salary every year, and there's no link to performance, because performance is solved in teams itself, and we don't have any issues with that. We know they will solve it, and solving performance just means that you need a strong team culture where people are able to discuss who is taking what task. And if people work together for a pretty long time, they will find out who's best suited for which part. You have this whole Clifton Strength Finder approach, etc. As certain people know, that you start with the strengths of people, and then this whole topic is in the end solved. So the most difficult thing is that you have to leave the mental box of the old output performance driven structures. And if you have left this mental box and just start from zero, and then you end, and then I make back the link to hospitals and teachers, those people, they work for purpose, and they don't want to have bonuses, because they said it would harm the way we work together in teams. So for our salary model, we took also as examples teachers, people who work in hospitals, people who work at universities. We didn't took the financial industry, because the financial industry has the salary model which doesn't work.
I think that's just the most appropriate response is a little bit of laughter, because that's a very, very true statement. Thank you for sharing that.
Do you think, Tom, as we start to wrap up today, because I'm going to go a little bit off piece, but what you're speaking to for me powerfully is around what I'm hoping comes out of this crisis we're all working through at the moment is the societal model. So, for example, basic income is a big conversation at the moment, universal basic income. So how do we actually take, as you say, giving people enough that they're doing those key services that all of a sudden the last 2 months are now our heroes who should be on €1 million a year and not €10,000?
Yep.
Like, so I'm just really wondering your thoughts around how can maybe the work you're doing in Visi help permeate the wider system of society by role modeling what you're doing and maybe almost helping different parts of the civil services adopt maybe some of the practices that are helping serve you.
Okay, that's also another podcast then.
We've got two more podcasts, Tom.
Now, perhaps you know Jos de Blok of Buurtzorg. You know Jos de Blok of Buurtzorg?
Sure.
So he has kind of a shadow cabinet. I was also invited a couple of months ago to join it. But we always gave the people who started to work for our company a book. And it was called Why Garbage Men Earn More Than Bankers. And it's about two social experiments. It's about garbage men who went on strike in New York. And after 4 weeks, the mayor has to raise their salaries. And it was about the strike in Ireland of the bankers, and nothing happened at all because people went to the pub and just wrote down which loan they gave each other. So, and this is a book we always gave to our people, and we always gave it to bankers who visited us and our business partners, because I like to give this book away. But let's say in the end, I hope the crisis will change something. But especially I hope that, there are two points where people have much more power than they think they have. So I hope people will not forget which companies treat us and society and their people and their clients and their suppliers in the wrong way. And I would just say, okay, just boycott or boycott those companies. And the sooner and more extreme we do this, if we just would say, we don't buy it from tomorrow on no pair of shoes of Adidas anymore, then this kind of behavior stops immediately, because the negative effect is so huge. And the other thing is just as employers, don't forget about the companies who treated the people well, and just apply for those people, for those companies who treated their people well, and try to do business with companies who treated the people well. So you can just make a list now, read the newspaper every day and say, I just make a list for after the crisis. These are the companies I'm not going to work together with anymore. And I will do exactly the same. I mean, I think we have all those companies around us because they were small and same attitude. But if there a company just comes by, which we work with, I will just call them and say, sorry, I don't like the attitude. We need another supplier. And if a lot of people do this, then you will be able to change society. But individuals have a much stronger possibility of changing this world to become a better place. It's not a kind of thing that only government can solve this or labor unions can solve this. No, everybody can solve this for her or his own. Perhaps sometimes it's a little bit more expensive. Perhaps are the clothes of Patagonia a little bit more expensive than Adidas, but please buy Patagonia and not Adidas.
The power within each individual, self-leadership, and the great freedom of choice, three things I just heard you eloquently speak to, and wonderful, wonderful segment, Tom. Thank you.
But that's also something, because I mean, I do a lot of interviews at the moment, but it's not about me, because everybody who works in a small place and where people, let's say, end up sitting in church on Sunday or going to the same shops and meeting each other, they're not able to treat their people like big corporations are treating their people, because they are not accepted by the local community anymore. People wouldn't like to talk to those people anymore. So there you have this kind of social mechanism still in place. But if you sit in a big tower and you're a multinational, then nobody cares, because you drive from with your big car to the Hamptons and then you tell other people that they should go to work again. I mean, I saw those interviews on Bloomberg. It's just disgusting. I mean, if you're sitting in the Hamptons and you say, home office is not a problem for me. No, everybody understands. But if you have to go on in a tube and working in let's say in a big environment where a lot of people are working and somebody has the coronavirus and you will end up having the coronavirus afterwards, then you should even be able to sue this company for sending you to the work again, because it was just too dangerous. And these are also things which in Europe already have started, that for instance they didn't close down the ski resorts in Austria, although they knew that people were ill, and now they're suing these local villages because they thought that their short-term profit of another week skiing was more important than the health of their guests.
So Rich, I want to keep this going for another hour, but I'm guessing you've both got lives that you need to go and get on with. So what I would like to suggest, Tom, you said twice on this conversation, that's another podcast. So I'd quite like to try and rope you back in for those at some point when the diary allows, if you're open to that.
Sure, always.
It's just brilliant. And I just want to thank you. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Tom, I love your humility, Tom. Like, it's not about you. I appreciate that greatly. But please also appreciate the role modeling that you are displaying. It gives me hope and it makes me excited for people to hear this conversation. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for inviting.
Tom, I the way that you do model and from the most genuine place, that it's not ideology, it's actually a daily belief and a daily practice that you exemplify for us all. With a great example and an exponential rollout to many other facets. So
I have to
thank you for the meeting as well.
I have to admit something because I listened to your talk yesterday, and you talked about how do you start your day and how do you end your day. And I have to explain perhaps one last thing. I had cancer when I was 20, and I had the chance of surviving of 20%. So in a way, it's not a real fair situation, because I mean, 30 years ago, I was nearly gone. So I'm very grateful. So every day since then is extra time. So for me, it's much easier to, let's say, to think that material stuff or maximizing profits is not where it's all about, because I experienced this when I was 20. So, and what you often see is that it doesn't matter. People have certain experiences in life. You have also this book, Second Mountain, etc. And then they find out it's not about money. And sometimes you have this experience much early in life. I was just lucky. I got it when I was 20. And other people, perhaps they were 10 years older, or some others will never experience it. Pity for them. So, but it's perhaps a little bit of an explanation where the drive comes from. And I see the compliment just for all those people who are not here sitting behind the mic and just caring about their companies and their people, this general small and medium-sized entrepreneur who is behaving excellently and brilliantly with big solidarity, but doesn't give interviews like I do at the moment.
Thanks for sharing that, Tom. And I'm just going to... It's funny, actually. I'm just going to share my screen. I've never done this on a podcast. Sorry for you listening. It's going to seem a bit weird. But I've literally been doing exactly what Tom speaks about and tracking the good. I'm calling it the good, the bad, and the ugly around what's going on at the moment. And it's just amazing. You know, I look at the list, I've already got a list of 20 odd people. Tom's on the good side. But I just want to put some reference out to people like Substack, who, like, they're giving $100,000 to struggling writers because of the COVID crisis. You know, the way that the Marriott CEO, the way he stood up and communicated clearly about the troubles that they're dealing with. So I would say, I just want to reiterate your point there, Tom, but also say, yeah, definitely SMEs. But it's also good we're starting to see some of the big guys come out as well, of the big multinational corporates, and saying, actually, this is about humanity as well. Yep, so I think the sort of that message coming both ways gives me hope.
Yeah, but let's say everybody reads about Patagonia because everybody knows Patagonia, but all those very small companies nobody ever heard of and are not interesting to write about. And these are the people, let's say, I talk for, I would say. But let's say the big majority is very decent, caring, and we are just, there's just too much attention for a few exceptions.
Yeah.
Which behave in a very bad way. And that gives us the impression that the world is bad. It's not.
What a beautiful way to wrap this up. So anything else from your side, Mike? Any final thoughts or questions for Tom before we go today?
No, well, a couple of things is I certainly look forward to that next conversation because this was so rich. And I do believe that we're in a fluid stream right now. And it will look, we're learning each day, each week. And I believe there'll be such continuity downstream from where we are in this conversation, which will be a wonderful mooring point of how sustainable these practices, these ideas are. And you've shared them so wonderfully with us today, Tom. And I grew during this call, and I really appreciate you.
Thank you very much for having me, and I hope it also will give strength to a lot of people to go this way and not the other way.
Yes, power of choice, so well stated.
How can people find you, Tom? What's the best way, social media wise or website?
Yeah, they can just connect me on LinkedIn. I also have most of the time I have time, so excellent people, the whole team. I'm just sitting here for 40 other people. So everybody can just connect on LinkedIn.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Tom. It's been a real joy. Have a great day, both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi there, Gary Turner, your podcast host here. Just wow. I'm really hoping that you enjoyed that conversation between myself, Mike, and Tom van der Lubbe from VizMe. I'm really flawed, and I'm flawed from the clarity and the direction of travel and the opportunity that exists for all of us, individually and collectively, to step into our power, to move the system to something healthier and more connected. I'm just absolutely blown away by that, and I'm going to spend some time, if you bear with me with that, great, if not, no problem at all. But there are so many takeaways that I took from this conversation. In case they help you or piece some of the jigsaw together, I wanted to share those with you. So first of all, Tom spoke about the fact that during normal times, we always have a clear hierarchy. It starts with purpose. The business is not meant to maximize profit, but it should be a multi-stakeholder approach. We can think about the business roundtable message that was given previously. We can think about BlackRock and their announcement we should be investing more in purpose-led organizations. All of these sound bites are great, but Tom and his team are actually role modeling that way of being and that way of doing to try and help move the system forward. And I just think there's so much hope and optimism and excitement in that particular vision. I also enjoyed hearing Tom talk about the fact that I think that it helps in good times if you have a collective team approach, so that in times of crisis, you have a competitive advantage as suddenly everything is about solidarity. And Tom mentioned a few times, as did Mike and I, around these beautiful examples of connected humanity at the moment, people looking out for each other, getting each other shopping, putting notes through the door, asking if the neighbour needs some help. That is our natural state. And I think Tom made that so crystal clear. And I think we all know that, anybody that's listening, that actually it's almost harder
to be individualistic and hide away from other humans than it is actually to connect. And I wonder what comes up for you as we share those reflections right now. And I think that message that Tom shared for me is a direct shot at silo working. Yeah, so in good times, you need to have a collective approach that you can deal with crises far more easily. I also enjoyed hearing Tom say that I think that we are the normal SMEs. It's also normal not to be egotistical. It's more normal to be altruistic. It's normal to help each other. What comes up for you when you hear that message? Tom also shared that if this, and he was speaking about the golden rule, he said it's part of your DNA. You don't have to invent something when you are in crisis times because everyone understands what the golden rule is. And I just think there's just something beautifully simple in that. And it reminds me of NextJump. So NextJump, the software house that is part of an everyone culture, deliberate developmental organization. So their purpose, as it were, or their values is better me plus better you equals better us. But what I really, really enjoy about Tom's is that it actually is even simpler. It's the golden rule. Simple as that. You know, treat others how you want to be treated. So, so powerful. I like the fact they have a virtual bench, so they're always engaging potential new consultants, new clients within their business. So, you know, you spoke about going from 40 to 280 people. You know, and as other companies are actually doing the layoffs that he's so vehemently against, he will just collect those people and recruit them into the organization and give them a far better employee and customer experience to boot with that. He also said that he likes no bosses and he likes everybody to be a leader. If you try and create an environment where people feel safe in their teams, people will all, in the end, become leaders, an important point here, as they act in their normal life as well. And I always think about Gary Ridge whenever I hear comments like this, because what is it? Why do we? What is it about us that we change, that we armor up when we go from our home lives into our work lives? Most of us, yeah. Why do we feel the need to change who and what we are based on the system that we're stepping into? I find it absolutely fascinating. So how do we actually create those safe environments? And if you're interested in the work of Amy Edmondson and psychological safety, which Tom references, if you go back to episode 29 of this podcast, I was grateful to host a conversation with Amy back then. And then finally, Tom speaks about the fact that try to take all of the financial bonuses and incentives out so that people can be vulnerable. Normally you can't be vulnerable because it has a negative effect on your own salary or bonus or the salary and bonus of your team. And there's such a close link here to the ego that Tom spoke about earlier on. If we don't have that carrot and stick, as Dan Pink's work in Drive, again, as Tom mentioned, as I'm sure you've read, if not, go and find the RSA Animate. It's only a 10-minute animation of the book Drive. And I'll include that in the show notes as well. You know, how do we try and reduce the amount of noise and friction in our systems, such that we can focus on just being our innate connected human selves? And I think this is one brilliant way to do that. You just layer up incremental increases in salary every single month for the next 20 years. You know, I think they're doing some really innovative stuff. There's some great Corporate Rebels articles that Tom's written in or been written about. Brilliant company, brilliant human being in Tom. Loved sharing this first multi-person experience in combination with Humans First alongside Mike Vicente, and just really excited, so hopeful after this conversation. I was before, but even more so now. And this is why we want to talk to more practitioners that are navigating these challenging times with this mindset, a growth mindset, a positive view on how we can be together once this crisis has passed. So if you've got any ideas about someone that you'd like to hear on the podcast, or maybe you'd like to join someone on this podcast for a conversation, let me know. You can find me on Twitter at Gary IP Catalyst, one word. You can find me on LinkedIn, Gary Turner Interpersonal Catalyst. And my email is GaryTurner0, all one word, with Gary with two R's at hotmail.com. You'll also be able to find Mike Vicente's details on Twitter and also on LinkedIn. You can find him under the Humans First movement. You can find him on MJ Vicanti on Twitter. And if you want to join any of the Humans First conversations, we are running at the moment one call per day. Every day you can join an opening and inclusive call. And there's also a two-day retreat taking place on the 30th and 31st of July in the UK, which was delayed due to the COVID challenges. But do let us know. Please share with us what resonates. Share us with what you're challenging. Share us with your ideas, how we can try and continue to role model humanity at a time of challenge. Until next time, I've been Gary Turner, and thanks for joining Tom van der Lubbe, Mike Vicanti, and myself today. Thank you.
Really hoping that you enjoyed that exploration on the Value Through Vulnerability podcast. You can find out much more about Hexo Change at hexochangenow.com. That's hexochangenow, one word, .com. You can subscribe to a weekly newsletter at that website, which includes information about live stream conversations, further service offerings, blogs, but also our in-person events, of which we have multiple each year. So I really hope that you'll join us. Do connect with me, Gary Turner, on LinkedIn, and I really hope to hear from you soon.